that's okay.
Thank you. I'm Lamar, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank the committee for making this mistake. But I'm grateful that they invited me because I'm almost home. I don't want any more jobs, but I'm a Pennsylvania Dutchman. I'm a dying breed. I'm a pure alcoholic, and I'm a kid that was raised bilingual. And next week I'll be in a church that my grandfather started. We're having a reunion, and where we spoke in German and read and singing. But you know, I forgot all that German, and you know what? You use it or lose it. That's not original. So, a couple of these old guys told me that. So thanks to the committee. And whatever I will be is by the grace of God and you people. I'm an alcoholic in recovery. I'm going to die an alcoholic. If you're an alcoholic, so are you. But when the sunlight of the Spirit comes in, it gives us confidence that we might die with alcoholism and not from it. And that's the name of that tune. That's the name of that tune. And when we get confidence in the future, it's one of the most blessed things that I've ever received. I'll tell you how I discovered I was an alcoholic. My brother brought me many years ago. After I get started, you'll know I'm a very opinionated person, and I never had opinions when I was drinking my first 10 or so years. But now that I'm old, I'm very opinionated because I just celebrated 43 years of sobriety. And I'm 76 years old. If you're not opinionated by that time, shame on you. My brother brought me to AA many years ago. I was sober a year and a half, and I proved this book to be correct. The same personal drink again, or something like that. I don't quote the book very good, and I read this book and the big book, and my wife says when it comes to quoting the big book, there's only one verse I know. Women, obey your husbands. Well, I know two verses. Right below that it says the older women are to teach the younger women to obey their husbands. And those Southern Baptists had a big fight over that last year. And so I don't read well. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was shocked when I found out I could hardly read, because when I went in World War II in 1943, I was told I was above average intelligence. By the time booze got through with me and sent me to you people, guess what you told me? You'll have to go with what you got left, son. Go with what you got left. And I don't read well. And I told my brother I drank after the first year and a half. I'll skip over that part because I had no... Putting a plug in a jug is fine. Putting a plug in a jug leads to sobriety. And you get so dry you can be set on fire. But recovering from alcoholism is a threefold thing. Now, I told him, a Dutch boy and a farm boy, and these hands milk many a cow. And one of the things you sit on to milk a cow is a milking stool. And a milking stool is a wonderful engineering feat. It's three-legged, and it fits the terrain. Whether there's floppers or whatever's in there, it fits the terrain. That's why it's three-legged. And this program is three-legged. And when you just put the plug in the jug and stop there, you're unbalanced. And so recovering from alcoholism and sobriety in my book are not synonymous. That's me, not anybody else. Sobriety and recovering from alcoholism are not necessarily synonymous. It's what you do after the plug's in the jug. It's what you do after this conference is over and the doors swing open and we go out into the ball game of life. Out there where the rubber meets the road. Practice, man. If you want to go to Carnegie Hall, practice, man, practice. says we practice these principles in all affairs. You don't go to AA. I realized that I was AA at home and at work. And I came here with my brother. He was a worse drunk than I was. And I want to thank my fine hostess. We got reacquainted after many years. But my brother brought me that first time, and he always put me in the back and with the coats and hats and didn't want anybody to see me. He was ashamed of me. And then after I drank in 56 and came back, he still put me back there with the hats and coats. Now, there's one verse in here I do know, one page, one line. And there are people who come here with grave emotional and mental disorders. But many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be
honest.
That's one of the key words. And my brother brought me. And the first time I was around here, when they mentioned the big book, I thought it was a Bible. And then when I came back in 56 for the first year and a half, I still thought it was the Bible. That's how sick I was. And I stood in the back. I was the skinniest guy in AA. The only shape I had was my Adam's apple. And my brother was one of those guys, when he drank, he swelled up. I guess his liver was shot. And after a while, they noticed me. They didn't notice me for months. I was back there standing with the coats and hats. And finally, they said, "What in the heck's that skinny guy doing back there?" They said, "Well, he's to make sure the fat guy gets here." But I came back, and that seems to be important, too, to come back. And I put the plug in the jug, and it seemed every 6 months I moved up a row. And it wasn't long, I was down with the incurables. And it took a long time. But I told my brother, I told him I couldn't read, and that's when he told me. He says, "Well..." And my primer in learning to read was the Balmer Prologue. And then the Grapevine, I still read the Grapevine. And my 24-hour book, I still don't read well. I don't retain that which I read. I try. So one of the things that got me and made me know that I was an alcoholic is because every meeting I went to years ago was a drunkalog meeting. It wasn't any of this "who struck John." And does anybody have a burning desire? And my brother was at a meeting in Tampa, Florida one time. He said, "Boy, there was about 60 people and they all shared." I said, "Well, if there had been 61, if I'd have been there, number one wouldn't have shared. I'd have left." Because I feel it's a grave responsibility to stand up here and break the bread of life. There are people that carry the message, but there are Typhoid Marys here that spread the disease. And I told you I'm a know-it-all. But one thing, if you don't speak at meetings, you don't shake hands, it don't take long to you have the winners picked on. And back in that era, you didn't drink coffee before and during the meeting. I go to some meetings today, and the people come in late and they drink 4 cups of coffee. They come in late and they shake hands with 4 people. And the guy's up here talking. And they drink 4 cups of coffee and they leave before the basket's passed. And I decided I was going to start a meeting at 12 o'clock meeting. And 12 o'clock, you lock the door. I was sharing in a meeting. Well, it's a good while ago now. And I hate those Ron Robbins in a way. I used to like them. But I was sharing and I started the meeting and I read a little bit from the book and started. And as soon as I started reading, this guy across the table on the other table was going like this. So when I was ready to call on somebody, I called on Betty because I knew Betty was sober and I knew her. That's my responsibility. So she said, "Lamar, that guy wants to talk." I said, "I thought he had to go to the bathroom." And I told her, I don't call them people I don't know. And I don't know what they are. And so I kept moving up, didn't read anything. But one of the things they did back in that era, they broke down your denial system. And another thing we did in that era, this was a rusty zipper group. You dig it? And this is the kind of group when a new guy comes in and we get together, and a couple of them old timers Dennis was talking about last night would say, I don't think he's ready, he still has a watch. But they would break down your denial system. And I got scared about that, not being able to read. So the only thing they read was that Balmer prologue. And we had a success rate back in that era, 85%, but somebody always wanted to improve on it. And I'd hate to tell you what it is today, because everybody kept improving things. Stop reading that, because I don't know. Maybe it's not conference approved. I don't know if Bill told you, but I'm not conference approved yet. But if you keep your mouth shut, you see better. And so I was getting a picture here. And I was getting a picture that the fat cats get at the trough. And I knew I was never a bench warmer. I don't want to brag on my sports life, but it was pretty good, if I do say so myself. But I was never a bench warmer. And I knew that putting the plug in the jug was basic. And I didn't want to pray. When you all said the Lord's Prayer, and we had a couple of guys quoted scripture. You knew those holy rollers. And I said, I don't want that Jesus number, that sawdust trail. Man, I'm tough guy yet. I still got some, didn't have any teeth, but I was tough. And I said, I don't want to hear that Jesus number. But I watched some of the winners, and they did certain things. They were participants, but they also did some other thing. Most of them went to church, and I didn't want to go that route. But putting you in a barn won't make you a horse. Putting you in a garage won't make you a car. And putting your butt in these meetings till it falls off won't hack it till you get on the road. And so I knew that I'd have to, maybe I could get well enough to read the prologue one day. So when y'all read it, one of our oldest members in Maryland, he still always carries one in his pocket, the Balmer prologue. And I always have a couple of them in my car. And so when y'all read it, I started reading it. And one thing about this program, it meets you at the level of your needs right now, whether you're from Yale or whether you're from jail. And I started reading that. And then I would go home and try to read it. And Alcoholics Anonymous met me at the level of my needs. In this prologue that we don't read anymore, because it worked. And there's one of the first lines in this program, prologue, is definitions of alcoholics are many and varied. For brevity, we think of an alcoholic as a person whose life is unmanageable to any degree due to the use of alcohol. And after I finally got to be able to read this and looked at that, all at once it says, it doesn't make any difference how long I drank, where I drank, what I drank, with whom I drank, was to be or not to be is the question. I'm an alcoholic, and I must refrain free of alcohol. And that includes O'Doul's, beloved. O'Doul's killed my baby brother, the professor, the all-knowing, the all-wise. He died penniless, the professor, and one of the most famous men in the West. What a sad thing. O'Doul's always took him back to the real McCoy. So all at once it dawned on me that crawling home wasn't necessarily social drinking. My father found me in the gutter before I was legally old enough to drink. And my father said, never come home, never contact me. You're no good and you'll never be any good. So social drinkers don't crawl home. They call home, but they don't crawl home. And so it dawned on me something else. It doesn't make any difference what kind of alcohol you drank. I told you I'm a Pennsylvania Dutch boy. My last name is actually Raider, but I go by anonymous name, Roeder. And I always hated my first name, never used it till I came here and you told me I had to be... Lamar seemed kind of swish. And I said, back in that era, I said, damn, a super jock like me, who in the hell, Lamar? Why? I said, I'm going to go by Jocko. So I had an alias all my life until I got honest here and used my right name. God, I'm glad I'm not a Joe. Quite, there's 20 Joes in here, 15 Mikes, but there's only one Lamar. And when y'all talked about alcoholism, I said, yeah, and something in every, I believe this is one thing we have in common. We're different. We're different. And that's okay. But everything used to cry out inside of me, yes, but I'm different. I told Pat about how different I was in high school. I've never been to a prom. I've been to bordellos and stuff in high school. Never to prom. I left football practice and drank shots and beers. Never to the social dance. I was different. That don't have anything to do with my alcoholism. And so I kept reading that, and pretty soon I got up one night and, well, the first thing I did, I still didn't want to believe in God, but I would accept my alcoholism. So we never had a group conscience meeting in the old Canton group where I was a member for 30 years till I moved. And I want to tell you something about joining a home group. If you don't want to attend it, don't join. Don't louse it up. I didn't miss over 5 days in my home group in 20 years, except vacation time. And if you think I'm bragging, I am. But I believe the backbone of Alcoholics Anonymous is the home group. That's where we break down the denial system. I'll tell you something else what the Canton group did. When a new person did come in, whether he had a watch or not, we rigged a meeting. We had this, always met up front, and we said, who's chairing the meeting? We got a new guy. Make sure he calls on just for today, George. And he was a bore. But boy, did he do a number on the new guy. He would read that just for today card and expound on it. And we got guys with 27, 30 years of sobriety in Ballmer. So first meeting I went to, I met big just for today, George. Sure he did. We rigged the meeting. We were about our father's business. And so one night, the hierarchy was gathered up on the table after the meeting like they did. And my sponsor brother was a carrier pilot. A couple of them were officers. I was a poor old staff sergeant of an old Army Air Corps, Bronchi Army Air Corps. I was a gunner. So I went up there. I think I might even salute it. I wanted what they had. You know why I wanted what they had? They told me what they had. They didn't tell me what they read. They didn't tell me what they heard. They told me what they experienced. And I wanted what they had. And I went up to that hierarchy. I've been coming for 2 years. Reporting for duty. I want to join Alcoholics Anonymous. My brother, Lieutenant Raider, looked at me and he said, I ought to lay five up your Dutch head. He said, don't you know you're a member of AA when you say you are? I said, sign me up. And I've been signed up ever since. And it's, and my report, if I don't say anything, it's swell getting well. And Virginia said it this morning. This program works on the good days and it works on the bad days. And I might tell you about a couple bad days. I don't know. But still there were things missing in my life. And we used to have the only guy in the Ballmer area had a beard. Only one guy. And we wore coats and ties back then. And this Eaton had been an old lawyer down in Louisiana and was under the bridge type of drunk. And every week he stabbed me. He said, "Those that don't bend the knees, bend the elbows." How many ever had audio DTs? I had them before they came out. You know, where you go out drinking all night and the next morning you're working and the sounds come out of the air and the steam lines in the moon. And when you're young, you can hum to them. But that goes too. But pretty soon I had audio DTs, but there were those that don't bend the knees, bend the elbow. And I was so sick. I was unemployed and unemployable. My wife had a good job. And when she left in the morning, I was on the sofa. And when she came home at night, I was on the sofa. And she said, "Lamar, what is it with you?" After a while, she noticed this. She said, "What is it with you?" I said, "What?" She said, "Every night leaving in the morning, you're on the sofa when I come home." I said, "Shut up, Annie, I'm sick. I got a disease." Easy does it. Next day, she come home with a bag with something in it. She said, "Hold out your hand." And she slapped something in it. She said, "Does that fit?" And I said, "Yeah, I guess." And it was a paint roller. She said, "Easy does it. Those that don't work don't eat." And I got to massaging the walls. And that was going through my head. Those that don't bend the knees, bend the elbow. Those that don't bend the knees, bend the elbow. I couldn't get rid of it. I come down off that ladder. I knelt by the bed that was folded up over there. And I said a prayer. I said, "Just as I am, without one plea, I'm through now. I can't hack it drunk. I can't hack life sober. I can't hack it drunk. I can't hack it sober. Will you help me?" They said you would. I expected the light like Bill Wilson got, but I didn't get the light. But I got shown the way. And I started going to church with Marla and Annie. And I don't want to scare Dennis, but I married into a Southern Baptist family. And when I was drinking, I used to show up at their... They used to... I'm married to Annie for 52 years. I know her for 55. And guess what? Some of those Baptists practice what they preach. My wife don't gossip much. And I've never heard my wife say a profane word unless dadgum it's profanity. She don't cuss. And she stuck with me. And the first thing alcoholism did was louse up my drinking. And then the second thing it did was get me sober where I really saw what I was and what I had been. But it also showed me what I could be. I took my wife, and I had some good jobs. I was with the company invented hospitalization life insurance. I sold groceries. I had good jobs. But I never had any money. And I took those girls through the muck and the mire to the extent where we lived in one room in East Ballmer. And we got thrown out of it. And we rented a apartment with no furniture. And today my daughter's a home economist by education, but back in that era we didn't have French provincial or early American, we had early NP. We slept on the floor and we had boxes for furniture. And I said, "Well, it can't get any worse than this." And the next day I got served a warrant for income tax evasion. That was hard to do in the 50s. Be arrested for income tax evasion. And they told me if I paid a little something every week, I could stay out of jail. And that turned me into a periodic. Because I had to stay out of jail. But then when I came to AA, I saw all these things. But I saw something in the lives that I wanted. Dignity. I got invited to their homes to picnics. And I realized what a mess I'd made in my own life. But what a terrible mess I made on Annie and Marla's life. And I said, maybe it'll change. And I'll tell you what kind of drunk I am. I was telling Pat about this. I said to Annie a long time ago, I don't know when it was, but I said, you always knew I'd stay sober. She said, no, I didn't. I never thought you'd stay sober. So now you know what kind of drunk I was. And I used to hang around the chip house. Some of you have been there. Some of you can't find it. And I used to go down there because it was kind of low bottom. And I didn't think I'd be allowed in Towson where they spoke trigonometry and that, you know. So I used to go to them low bottom, like I said, rusty zipper groups. And I used to go to this meeting, and today I go to meetings, a new guy comes in. You know what they do? They run up to him. You know what? They say, you're the most important person in the room. This is a selfish program. Work it your way. I used to go down to Chippa's, and the head guy down there, he was from Boston. You know how in Boston they pack the car. And he had a broken index finger. No matter where I sat, it looked like he was pointing at me. He said, you're here to play games? Get the hell out! Don't let the door hit your ass on the way out. Get out! Why would you like that? I think they call that tough love. But I kept going on there, and I'd hide behind this pole. I was so skinny, I could hide behind this pole. And one day, I thought I was a notch above some of these low-bottom drunks like Mike and some of them guys I know back here, my homeboys. And I thought I was a notch above my brother and some of them. I never sold blood. Didn't have any. And he come up to me one night after the meeting and put his arm. I hate it when I didn't shake hands. I didn't. And you thought, boy, if you'd all hugged me, I'd have died. But he come up and put his arm around me. He says, Lamar, he said, keep coming back. He said, if you can stay sober, anybody can. So remember to carry that to your own life and your pigeons. I met a guy today. If he can stay sober, anybody can. So, and every meeting I went to back then, I don't know what time we started. It's one thing I can't tell time, I can't. Every meeting I went to years, I got to take my coat off. You know I have one now, so. It's hard to find that size at the Goodwill. But every meeting I went to, we were about our Father's business. And I think nearly every speaker years ago would say this, you can't keep it unless you give it away. That's the first conclusive fact that Bill Wilson came up with there in the hotel. He had to find a drunk. And I know another verse in his book. It says, if you don't have a drunk, find one. Does it say that or not? Did I read that correctly? God, I'm getting better. And so I said, geez, I can't carry the message. I don't have the message myself. But after I went to church with Annie and Marla, they sang my prayer, just as I am. And I started eventually going on 12-step calls because you know why? I wanted what you had. And I knew you were telling the truth when you said those that don't bend the knees bend the elbow. And those that don't carry the message bend the elbow. So I went on a 12-step call. And did you ever, you know, I told you I thought I was a super jock because I was written up in the paper twice, and I was a pro one time. I made $5 when I was 17 for playing basketball. And but if you want a thrill, and we're going to go back to this, so listen up. We're going to be back knocking on doors. You want to build character? You knock on a door and represent Alcoholics Anonymous. There's no higher calling than that. Does Joe Dunn live here? Yes, it's up in bed. It was always it. It's up in bed. It's up. And I went to see this one guy, and so I thought, well, I'll give him my gory drunkalogue. I won't give him my Sunday one. I said, yeah. I said, I grew up on Dandelion wine and homebrew, and my brother and I, my sponsor brother and I, were the brew masters and capped the beer. And during, I learned to drink during Prohibition when it was illegal to drink. I'm that old. And so I told this guy, he's in bed. They used to be in bed. You want to learn how to pray? You 12-step them suckers that are in bed. You pray. You know what you'll tell God? Nothing fancy. You'll tell God, don't let this sucker die. And so I told this guy, I said, yeah, well, I went in the Army. I went down to South Texas. And I drank a lot in the war and after the war in South Texas. And I said, I appeared in a public sexual exhibition where dues and fees were charged in Matamoros, Mexico. And he perked up a little. And then I said, when home movie cameras come out, we made a movie and got drunk and showed it to our wives, and they're all divorced but me. And then I said, well, and then I smuggled a Mexican prostitute out of the Zona de Tolerancia and took her into Texas. If you ever had their man act read to you, baby, you'll get spiritual. When they lock you up and you know the charge is the man act. I didn't pray much till that night. I said, Jesus, it's Lamar. Remember me? I'm one of John Brown's grandsons. So I told this guy, and he started stirring when I told him about drinking all that Carta Blanca beer and that tequila, and the bouncers chasing me down the alleys, and this jackpot and that jackpot. And he started stirring. He says, help me up. And I helped him up to the bathroom. He started cleaning up. I said, does this mean you're going to a meeting with me? He said, hell no, I'm going to Mexico. If you think I'm kidding about that, we had a buddy just come back from Matamoros. So I shouldn't tell that story anymore. And so I had some successes and I had some failures. But I tell you, God put in my life some important people. God put in my life some people. And my father had convinced me I was no good and I'd never be any good. But I said, well, maybe my life can count for a little something here. I had pigeons that were on their second set of kids. They had ruined the life of a woman and had 3 and 4 and 5 kids with her and left her. And now, Herbie, I went to his house, and what a mess. And he had 5 little kids there. Went to Joe's house, the same thing. And I said, well, maybe my life could count for something. And I worked harder with those type of families because I love children. And I did some things you shouldn't do in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I did them. I took Herbie's children to Sunday school. I saw that they had something to eat. I saw that they had love. Did you ever walk in a grocery store 20 years later? You walk down the aisle and you're doing the shopping now and cooking, and you bump into a handsome young man, has one of them expensive suits and one of them Gucci loafers. He said, Lamar? I said, yeah. A tear ran down his cheek. Come on, hug me. He said, I never thanked you. I never thanked you. He said, if it hadn't been for you and your brother, we never would have amounted to anything. So I want to thank you. I want to thank you. That boy's a big-time operator in the insurance world. I went to my daughter's graduation some years ago in Carson Newman near Knoxville. And Herbie's, this boy's grandfather, Herbie's father, my pigeon father, lived there. And he said, would you call my father and go see him? I said, yeah. And I couldn't find him. He lived in Sevierville below the Smokies there. And time got away, and my daughter and wife told me, you'll be on time for supper. We're having, you know, the click. I said, all right. So I said, well, at least maybe I can call him. And I called Herbie's father. Now, this is a guy I hauled him to so many meetings, one and two a day for years. I hauled him to so many meetings, I finally gave him the car. Here you go. Get a pigeon. And I called his father. And his father, I'm hard of hearing. And sometimes that's beneficial, but I heard what was said last night and this morning. But I was on the phone with old man Cato, and he said, huh? And I said, our friend of Herbert's. I'm from AA. I worked with your son Herbert. And this went on and on. He couldn't. And finally it hit him what I said. And this is what old man Cato said to me. AA! He said, my God, what an outfit that must be. They made a man out of my Herbert. That bum that used to mess his pants sitting at the bar, he messed his pants one night in a bar, and he just sat there, and the bartender kept... This is the kind of drunk he was. And the guy finally come over, he says, haven't you messed your pants? Herbie says, yeah. He said, well, why don't you go clean up? He says, because I'm not finished yet. After I gave him that car, he got a job at Crownsville, and he learned a trade. He became a stationary engineer, and eventually he wound up working at the Maryland Penitentiary making steam. He run the powerhouse. And guess what that bum... retired as a lieutenant from the Maryland State Police. Owned a farm in Knoxville, near Knoxville. He's in a nursing home down there now. But he had a great life. Had a nice home in East Baltimore. This isn't the end when you come to alcoholics. It's a new beginning. This is where that sunlight of the Spirit takes over. And I started going to church with those girls. And I took jobs. I took one job with young men, young boys. I took them bowling and took them to the ball game and several things. I must have done a good job. One of them married my daughter. And my son-in-law was sitting there one day, and he looked at me real funny. This is a boy that lost up a drugstore that I had invested in. He lost his pharmacy license. Now he's a CPA. But he looked at me. He said, you know what I'm most grateful for in my whole life? I said, no. He said, the most thing I'm grateful for in my whole life, I married into a family in recovery. This is a family disease. And this is a family recovery. And my wife has told me more than once she thought she was sicker than I was. But we recovered together. You know why? We prayed together. At supper time, when I started making amends to Annie, you know what my first amends were? Coming home the same day I went to work. There's a few of you that dig that. That was an amend. Coming home every night. Payday, I gave her most of my pay. I still stole $10, but that's a joke in the family now. I finally confessed. But I used to knock down $10. But I used to give her my pay. And she wrote a poem about me one time, and how we had a love affair, and how I went down the wrong path for a while and came back. And she said in this poem that I was always late for supper, sometimes a day, sometimes two, sometimes three. That's late for supper. And so I didn't know where to start being a father. You know, when you come out of that alcoholic world, if you're in, like, if you look when I go by you tonight, you'll see my butt shaped like a bar stool. That's all I knew. My sex was in the bar room. My athletic endeavors were in. I went to the bar room from morning till night. Saturday morning, you get the opening load, the nooner, the closing load. He knows that's a sinner there. And so here you are, now you're sober. Social graces are foreign to you. Being a father is foreign to you. Being a husband is foreign to you. Where do you start? You ask for help. And one of the first things we did, we became a family. And my mother lived with me for 20 years. You know why? I was at least of 6 kids. My mother lived with me because she said I had the best friends of anybody in our family. That included old Dr. So-and-so. And she said, I like to live here because you people don't holler at each other. And when we started eating supper tonight, that wasn't only our evening meal. That was communicating time and prayer time. A family that prays together stays together. That's not original either. And you didn't come to this table in t-shirts and stuff. You didn't have to wear a tie, but you came to church table looking presentable. You didn't fill your plate and go in front of the TV and lay on the sofa and put your feet up on the sofa. You sat up the table. And we talked. And we got to know each other. Glory to God, don't miss it. We got to know each other. I became a father to a child. I took her to the library and tried to motivate her towards cultural things. I took her and got her first pair of glasses. I was there when my wife needed me. I was there when my daughter needed me. I was there. And so we started trying to build this house, and it wasn't always easy. I had a lot of setbacks in my life, and Virginia said something about this program this morning, but I want to tell you this, repeat what she said. This program works on the good days, but it works best on the bad days. I told some of the things that happened to me at a conference one time. I stood over here and a guy slipped a fin in my pocket, so I'll be over here with Bill Anthony. But some bad things started happening, and in May my wife was paralyzed from the waist down from chicken pox, herpes zoster, and she's been paralyzed for 15 years. I was with Big George. Where's Big George? That big ugly. Oh, there he is. I was with George and Fred and them up on the Eastern Avenue at McDonald's. I went home, my wife's on the floor, peed in her pants, and she couldn't get up. And I was lucky to get a hold of the doctor. He says, bring her to the hospital and call your son-in-law and tell him to get a wheelchair. I took her to the hospital. I want to tell you something. This program made a man out of Herbert, and it made a man out of me. These hands that used to choke Annie and put his fist through the wall for emphasis and smash everything in the house are now the hands that cleaned her butt. These are now the hands that cleaned her catheters. I had my wife in Franklin Square twice, 3 times, Mercy twice, Good Samaritan 2 times, you name it, Hershey for test, everywhere. She's still paralyzed. Her mind's been good lately. But a friend of mine in AA tried to help me because he saw the writing on the wall, my home was going to have to go. I don't drive big cars. You know I'm Cadillac material by now, but I don't. I'm lucky I'm driving a 4-banger. But when the going gets tough, the tough get going. That's not original, is it? But boy, what are you going to do when you see that your house is going to have to go? What are you going to do when you see your stocks and bonds are going to have to go? I told you we came from one room. But we're planning trips abroad. It's almost graduation time. You know one of the most important things in Alcoholics Anonymous? Just for today. Just for today. Just for today. One day I stood there and said, my God, what am I going to do? And that small voice came into my heart and head. You're going to do what you've been doing. Press on. I want to tell you one more calamity. I have a whole bunch of them. I have so many operations. I told Pat, she couldn't believe it. And I'm going to show you my... You put something in my pocket, I'm going to show you my scars over here. Some guys, a couple friends I met today, they graduate, they get them tattoos. Well, I gather scars. I'm the scarred man. And I recovered from two incurable illnesses. One is alcoholism. Everything I thought I was going to get out of booze and drinking it as a young guy, I'm getting. Not in drinking it, but abstaining from it one day at a time as it now become my strength. No longer a stumbling block, but it's become a stepping stone. And then you took the stepping stones and you made an arch through which we're going to go to freedom. Free at last. Free at last. Whether you're broke or not. 2 years ago, I sat at the doctor's office. He said, I hate to tell you this. But you have cancer. And I hate to tell you this. But you're going to lose your kidney on this side. And you're going to lose the whole urethra tract. What do you do now? You pray. You pray. And you ask everybody that knows how to pray. I told these guys to pray for me tonight. They need the practice and I need the prayers. I started praying. And I have a couple doctors that saw me recently and they're amazed that I'm walking. They're amazed that I'm here. And I'm not telling you this to impress you. But I had this operation and Mike offered to take me to the hospital, a couple of guys in here. Because my daughter lives about 20-some miles from me. And they said, she'll have to sit here all morning and it was going to be an early operation. And I said, I don't care. When you love like I love, you want your daughter to be there. And I told Mike, I want Marla to be there when we wheel me in there. And the first face I want to see when I come to, if I come to, the first face I want to see is Marla Sid's. And it worked that way. And then Marla stayed with me for 4 days later. But I was in intensive care for 5 days. And I was in a little longer, another day or so. And I couldn't eat, but they sent me home. And I wore a catheter for 6 weeks. And I didn't leave the house for 6 weeks. The pain was so bad. I want to tell you, a gem can't be polished without friction. And neither can man's life be perfected without adversity. You'll know how good your program is when you're in your own head for 6 or more weeks. You'll know. And some days I'd say, God, this is Lamar. Remember me? I had... Mike took care of me. He's my neighbor. He brought my mail and paper in every day and even washed my sheets. But I was sick. I was sick. The pain was terrible. And Every time when I was at my lowest ebb, a knock would come, and here comes an old pigeon. We used to call him Wild Bill, and now we call him Sweet William. And Sweet William would show up. His wife is one of the finest cooks in Balmer, and they'd bring me food, and I couldn't eat for a long time, but I'd try to force. He said, force yourself to eat. And Bill would bring me food, but he brought me something else. He brought me hope, and he brought me joy. Joy unspeakable and full of glory. I might sing two verses of that after all. But he came, and he would cheer me up and leave. I 12-stepped him in 1960 at a phone booth when he did. I don't know where he got the nickel for the call. They were nickeling. But sometimes the bread you cast on the water in 1960 shows up in 98. And that bread you cast on the water comes back 100-fold. You see, he don't know why he's here. I finally told him. I took him to, I had a bunch of pigeons out like Herbie, and I had a route in East Balmer. I picked these guys up every night. And sometimes I overbooked and had to call my brother to take the overflow. And I'd haul these guys. I wasn't carrying the message, but damn, I was providing transportation. And I took him to meetings every day for 11 months or more, and he drifted away. Some people do. And Annie Ruth and I had a special attachment to him. He only had 3 kids. But some nights we got on our knees by the bed, and you know what our prayer was? Lord, make him so miserable he'll come home. But Lord, protect him. And don't let him get hurt till he comes home. And we prayed and prayed that prayer because we loved Bill and his family. And one night I walked in, and here come old Wild Bill. There's the people that fed me. Mike brought me a blessing one day. I was a sponsor in the Maryland Penitentiary for 16 years. I don't want to tell you about it. When I started getting well, I tried to do away with 2 words in my vocabulary, I and me, and replace them with we and he. And so a lot of times I don't like to tell people, but some of these guys told me, how are we going to know if you don't tell us that you had all those pigeons, that you had a carload of men in your car every night for years and years? How are we going to know that the hundreds of times you banged on that door and represented us? How are we going to know if you don't tell us? And when I think it was Mike showed up one day with a nice-looking young man. And many years ago, I worked with this boy's father. He was doing time in the penitentiary for murder. And now his son's got, what, 4 years, Mike? Now his son's over 4 years. So that bread you cast on the water, baby, it never returns void. So I went on and on. I want to tell you one more story, and I'll promise I'll quit. I got diarrhea of the mouth. You already found that out. When you give me the jug of wine, I take it. And my mother lived with us and she was a country girl. My both parents were raised on farms, and we had a farm part-time. And my mom, we had a little porch front row house in Holland Town. And I came home one night, my mom had invited a con man up on the porch, and I gave him the heave-ho, and I told my mom, I said, don't do that anymore, this isn't the country. I tried to explain it in a nice way. And she said, young man, I want to tell you something. I'm a good judge of character. I can judge people. I said, well, I knew you were gifted. And so the following Christmas, this was in the fall, following Christmas when we went to the penitentiary years ago in Balmer, we had the run of the place. We took people to meetings, and Lonzo said to me, the head, my buddy, he's in the Hall of Fame. Do you have a Hall of Fame? I got a Hall of Fame. Those guys in my whole home group, they came from a life of shame, but now they're in my Hall of Fame. You know why? They had me. And Lonzo was one of my biggest helps, taking me to the pen and getting me involved in some thing. And he said, are you going to be home Christmas Eve? I said, yeah, now that we're sober, we don't want to go anywhere. We want to go to church. And we want to sing to the glory of God. And we want to thank God for you. And then we want to leave church and go down to Chip Hoss to the midnight in the Alcathon and sit in the back and hold hands and cry with joy. Tears of joy and tears of sorrow are chemically different, they tell me. And we want to sit back there. So we'll be home. So he says, well, why don't you pick up three guys and take them to a meeting? He said, Kenny, George, and whatever it is, Lester. I said, all right. So no, we ran to prison AA. So I go over there and pick these three guys up. We didn't have to sign anything or get frisked or anything. We never did. And so I picked these three guys up. And Gracie was waiting to see one of them. This is before tattoos were fashionable. And she had them, baby. She was a circus geek. Baby, she had them. And she had a gown on, and so Mom didn't see them. Girls didn't wear them back then. And so I bring these three guys, and I said to Annie, I said, now she knew them because my family used to go to the meetings in the pen with me. We used to have Christmas parties and parties. And I said, be here to help me entertain them. She said, okay. So she always gussied it up on Christmas, and I never liked that. But you got to go with the flow. And so I bring these guys home, and like I told you, we wore coats and ties. And these guys have coats and ties on. We're sitting there. And my mother comes in, and Annie's serving punch and cookies and whatever. And they're having a time of their life. And my mom comes in. I introduce them. We go to the meeting. I come home. My mother said, young man. I said, yeah, Mom. She said, I want to tell you something. I told you this before. You have the best friends of anybody in our family. I told you some of my brethren were well known. She said, you have the best friends. And you know what? Damn if she wasn't right, because I met you this weekend and renewed my acquaintance with Patricia and some of you. I do have the best friends. But those three men I had in my house were all three murderers. And I told my mother, I said, that proves what you told me here a while back. You certainly are a good judge of character. And I walked away. And my brother and sister said, didn't you ever tell her? I said, no, it was too precious. And so when them guys went back to their cell that night, they told everybody within earshot, we were in a real house tonight, and we were treated like real people. We were treated like real people, not murderers. We were treated like real people. Out of that visit, some years later, I ran into several guys, and they said, you know why we came to AA? I said, no. Because when you had them guys in your house that night, they came back, and we wanted to see if you'd treat us like real people. Don't judge people in prisons. Carry the message. And so I'm going to read a poem if I can find it. I always read this, and I should. I wasn't going to read it, but I will.
Got candy to read.
See this?
Tomorrow,
I got one here for you. Thank you. Thank you. I got one. See, I gave her one. I'm going to leave one here for Bill. Many years ago, I had a friend, and I was staying with him on vacation. And they said, put your clothes and bags in the back room. I put them back there. I come down the hall. This was one of my rich friends and relatives with a couple bedrooms. And I looked in this one bedroom, and something caught my eye, and I went in. And it was the most beautiful bedroom set I ever saw. It was masculine. The grain, the color. So I went out and told this friend, I said, there's something new here. Where did you get that bedroom set? She said, sit down and I'll tell you. She said, you remember that multimillionaire, one of the richest guys in Exxon? That's how years ago? I said, yeah. When he died, that was his bedroom set, and he threw it away in the storeroom. And he was single, and his family, all they fought over was the multi-million dollars of stocks he had. But they threw that in the storeroom, a throwaway. And her son came home from Korea. He wanted to go out on his own, so she said, well, why don't you go up and get that bedroom set and use that? So he did until he got married, and it wasn't good enough for his wife. And they threw it away again. It was thrown away for the second time out in the barn. Evelyn went out there one day and looked at that bedroom set, and she couldn't get over how beautiful it was. And she said, it's like you guys and girls. You have potential. Michael explained what potential is after all. But you have potential. So she called a guy, and he came, took it. An hour later he called. He said, lady, do you know what you have? She said, no. He said, this is the most perfect bedroom set in the United States. This bedroom set was made for and by Frank Lloyd Wright. She said, well, don't you dare tell anybody. She still has it. That thing must, no telling what that thing's worth. Throwaways. That's what many of you are. That's what I was when my father told me never to come home, never to contact him. My father-in-law didn't talk or shake my hand for 13 years. But you have to be patient when you make those amends, because you see, my father-in-law wound up being one of my best friends. You know why my father-in-law didn't shake hands with me or like me? Number one, I was a drunk. Number two, I was born above the Mason-Dixon line. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. That old Louisianan didn't want anybody in his family above the Mason-Dixon line. And so there's all kinds here. And this sums it up. And a kid said to me recently, well, I always tell this. People come up to me and they say, how many times have you read that? 5? I said, yeah. 10? I said, yeah. 20? I said, yeah. 50? 100? Yeah. They said, how come you look at the paper? I said, keep drinking and you'll find out. Remember what I said when I started? Many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be. And I learned to read here. I learned to love here. I learned to care here. 'Twas battered and scarred, and the auctioneer thought it scarcely worth his while to waste much time on the old violin. But he held it up with a smile. What am I bid, good folks, he cried. Who'll start the bidding for me? $1, $1, now two, only two. $2, who'll make it three? $3 once, $3 twice, and going for three. But no. From the room far back, a gray-haired man came forward and picked up the bow. And wiping the dust from the old violin, and tightening the loosened strings, he played a melody pure and sweet as a caroling angel sings. The music ceased, and the auctioneer, with a voice that was quiet and low, said, now what am I bid for this old violin? And he held it up with the bow. $1,000, who'll make it two? $2,000, who'll make it three? $3,000 once, $3,000 twice, and going, cried he. The people cheered, but some of them cried, we not quite understand what change it's worth. Quick came the reply, the touch of the master's hand. And many a man with life out of tune and battered and scarred with sin is auctioned cheap to a thoughtless crowd, much like that old violin. A mess of pottage, a glass of wine, a game, and he travels on. He's going once, he's going twice, he's going and almost gone. But the master comes, and the foolish crowd never can quite understand the worth of the soul and the change that's wrought by the touch of the Master's hand. I felt that touch from your heart to my heart tonight. And I thank you for loving me till I could love myself. I'm thanking you for showing me the way, for that there could be no charge. And this old violin, maybe someday will amount to something. Thank you, and I hope you get what's coming to you and not what you deserve.